This is Tom and Homicide Solutions, February 2011, and this month we continue our journey to discover the main differences between replaceable vendors and respected authorities. We look into their mindsets, their behaviors, and their operations. Last month we discussed 11 differences, and this month I'll torture you with 11 more. Some of these differences apply to your company in a positive way, that is, in that area your company is a respected authority, but we all have replaceable vendor characteristics. It applies to all of us to a certain degree. And these are the little chinks we want to correct in our armors so we can come across as the perfect authorities that buyers are looking for. Of course, we can never achieve perfection, but it's worth traveling on the road that takes us closer and closer to it. So let's see what we have here. Buyers, that's point 12. Buyers dictate the rules of the game, and sellers, desperate for the new business, accept anything that might lead to a signed purchase order. Basically, buyers beat their drums and sellers dance to buyers' drum beats. There is no collaboration here, only do as I tell you type dictation. And due to poor market positioning, sellers can't cherry pick because qualified prospects are scarce, but people have to eat, so, well, they have to accept any kind of business. So how do you recognize game dictating buyers? Their project descriptions are far too tactical, and their strategic foundation is missing. For instance, they may say, "We need an Apache server with 12 workstations running on Windows 7. It's like walking into a medical clinic and demanding 2 pounds of Tylenol. "Why?" the doctor would ask. We can recognize bottom feeder buyers by doing their own diagnosis. So, what do good buyers do? They say something like, "Fred, we want to grow our online sales by 35% next year to an annual $42 million, and we need a robust IT backbone to be able to handle this growth. When could we sit down with you and scope out the technical specifications of this system and the financial aspects of setting it up?" Now, this is something strategic, this is something meaningful. But when buyers start specifying the means to achieve a certain end, then there's a problem. But in the latter case, this buyer has a specific boardroom caliber goal that needs a reliable server room support. But do you notice that the buyer is not looking for technical solution? He's looking for a business solution to pull off the projected 35% annual increase in online sales. Of course, the business solution will be accomplished through a technical solution, let's say faster server or more up-to-date operating system or something. And there's a huge difference here. Number 13, buyers set the fees and the prices. And all sellers can do is either to accept them or move on to the next stage of lukewarm consideration. And all sellers can do is either accept the terms and move on to the next stage of lukewarm consideration or reject the terms and drop out of the bidding contest. Buyers also know that these sellers can be further pressurized to lower their fees and prices, so they usually pressurize them, often to the point where it becomes financially prohibitive to do business with these buyers, But these sellers are desperate for money right now, so they accept the lower fee without a problem. They can't think of the consequences down the road. This is what economics often call winner's curse. It means that the seller that wins the bidding battle and gets the contract is really the biggest loser of all contestants. The poor bastard just doesn't know it yet. It will cost more to deliver the solution as per the contract than the seller can keep as a profit, so the seller subsidizes the project out of its own piggy bank. Not to mention that these buyers have astronomical demands. They may run their computers on pirated Windows 95, but demand top-tier technical support from their already overstretched and underpaid IT company. Also, these buyers are notorious for demanding their money back after the full installation of the new system. In 2007, I had the opportunity to attend Verisage Fellow and Project Management Magician at Class's Project Management Workshop for IT Companies. He mentioned an example that after some serious construction modification and full installation of the new system, the buyer demanded his money back. The dimwit thought he would get his money back and the IT company would leave all the hardware behind fully installed. But the IT company removed the new hardware and left. And where was the old hardware? Well, behind the building in the dumpsters. The buyer was left there with gaping holes in the walls because, of course, the seller picked up all the machines, pulled out all the cables. But, of course, it's not the seller's responsibility to undo the construction work. So, that was an interesting situation. And yes, I advocate full money-back service guarantee, but it doesn't mean that you leave the hardware behind or go back with a construction crew to restore the construction to the previous condition. That's not your job. The buyer pulled the plug on your guarantee and you return the money as per the agreement, but the agreement doesn't say that you have to restore the building in terms of construction or reinstall the old system. Number 14, the sales process dynamic goes apeshit. Sellers are pushing hard to make the sale as quickly as possible, while buyers take their sweet times and cherry pick among sellers. Buyers can take it easy because there is always a healthy supply of vendors groveling at their feet, hungry for some new business. And sellers push hard because that's what sales trainers have been teaching them for decades. Push, push, push harder and harder. We need aggressive bulldog-type salespeople. But I believe the sales territory favors reluctant sellers who offer kick-ass solutions coupled with effective education-based direct response marketing. Those sellers do such good marketing that self-qualified buyers come to ask them for their help. At least, it's a lot more effective than flooding the market with an army of aggressive peddlers that buyers try to avoid like the plague. Just look at the so-called internet marketing gurus. They run multi-million dollar businesses without one single traditional salesperson who pounds the pavements and dies for dollars. Actually, this is why I'm a bit surprised when I see ads on various HR or career sites that internet marketing companies looking for salespeople. You must be ready to do hundreds of cold calls. Like, internet marketing company, that's interesting. And the internet marketing company can't market itself out of a paper bag. Well, that's totally amazing. Anyway, so these gurus do such good marketing that they don't need salespeople. and IT companies could do something very, very similar. What if you figured out the buying process of your target market? You could sell the same amount of stuff or even more without one single salesperson. And even if your salespeople are on straight commission, they still cost you money. They still cost you a pretty penny, basically. So when so-called experts say that put your salespeople on straight commission and they won't cost you money, well, they cost you more than money, because the other problem is these people, since all the other people in the company are paid salary for plus bonus, these people are straight commission, so they feel alienated from the rest of the company. They don't feel they belong to the company, so they say that, hey, we are basically mercenaries, and if we find a better deal, we just leave the company and go to the better deal. The problem is, whatever client, the clients they bring to the table are not your clients, it's theirs. So when they leave, they take those clients with them. Now, it's silly to say that anyone owns those clients, but when your salespeople are on straight commission and when they leave your company and they entice their clients to follow them, that's perfectly okay, and you may get ticked off about it, but hey, they brought them in and they had the right to take them away. And there's one more aspect to the straight commission thing. The straight commission mindsets will keep your company a vendor forever. Just think about it. How would your opinion change about your family doctor if you found out that he's on straight commission, paid by some big pharmaceutical companies? Of course, many of them are really on commission from pharmaceutical companies, and pharmaceutical companies pay them big money to peddle their drugs. And many of them, actually, some research I read a few months ago, over 60% of doctors are involved in various deals with big pharma to peddle their stuff. Would you trust someone whose only incentive to do his work is the money that he can pull out of other people's pockets? Well, it's hard to trust these people. Number 15, using lots of FaceTime to arm twist buyers into quick purchases. Vendors do anything in the hope of the next deal, even wasting inordinate amounts of FaceTime to meet buyers, 97% of whom are not even ready to buy. And a large percentage of the 97% are tire kickers, bargain hunters, penny pinchers, tightwads, and cheapskates. They are not bad people per se, they are just not high caliber clients. The problem is that many IT companies' sales mantra is it's easier to persuade the reluctant and apathetic masses to buy something they neither want nor need than find those who really want or need our stuff. So they invest a huge amount of money persuading the masses instead of ferreting out those people, those buyers who really want what the sellers sell. Many sellers believe that if they put in lots of FaceTime to meet or Tom, Dick and Harry, that will speed up the sales process for them. But there is a problem. Sellers want to put in the most FaceTime at the beginning of their relationship when buyers don't want to meet them yet. Buyers want to meet them later, but by then sellers are off to the newer prospects. According to B2B marketing expert Mac McIntosh, 25% of buyers buy within 6 months, 25 by within 12 months, 25 by within 18 months, and 25 by after 18 months, yes. So it's fairly even, but you can see that the instant buyers, well, are few and far between. And I can say pretty confidently that the 25% that buys within 6 months are the low-end, price-sensitive buyers, and the ones that buy after 12, 18 months are the premium buyers. Somehow, in my experience, premium buyers do their due diligence before they make purchases. But there is another side to the same coin. In his book, The Ultimate Sales Machine, Chet Holmes reports that 3% of prospects are ready, willing, and able to buy right now. 7% of prospects are open to buying someday in the future. 30% of prospects don't even think about buying. 30% of prospects don't even think they are interested in buying. And 30% of prospects know for sure they are not interested at all. Not now, not ever. And the reason why low-end buyers buy so quickly is because sellers drop their trousers and offer all sorts of retarded, often self-punishing discounts to grab the quick buck. But that's exactly what low-end buyers are looking for. Bargains, bargains, and more bargains. Walmart and other merchants of cheap, shoddy crap have conditioned the masses really well. But smart sellers also know that quick bucks are hardly ever big bucks, and big bucks are hardly ever quick to make. So instead of flexing their sales muscles and scaring lots of quality buyers away, they use education-based direct response marketing to stay in touch with buyers until they are ready to buy. Unlike selling, which is a human intense function, a large chunk of the stay in touch process can be automated, so that makes life easier. And even if there's a certain level of rejection, an automated system can handle rejections much better than humans. Number 16. A lot of money is wasted on institutional image marketing. These are IT companies with the flashy, glitzy, glamorous marketing materials that are full of style but usually void of substance. Of course, replaceable vendors are not respected experts, so they don't have much valuable content to offer in their marketing and sales processes. Direct response marketing is based on good content, but good content takes time, thinking, and money to create. And smart buyers don't get their decision-influencing information from easyinarticles.com or similar article farms. They know that most of those articles are written by 250 per hour, quote-unquote, writers in India, Pakistan, or even Zululand. Also, image marketing, due to its self-centered, egomaniac nature, is exciting to the executives, and due to its not accountable nature, is popular among creative advertising agency people and super aggressive, money and promotion hungry, freshly minted MBAs. Look at your company's collateral materials and see what their overarching themes are. Are they seller-centered, chest-beating about the number of offices, the size of the company, the age of the president, and the Ivy League education of the CIO? Or are they about the target market's afflictions and aspirations, their buyers' goals, dreams, and frustrations? Replaceable vendors, due to their innate insecurity, love bragging about themselves. Respectable authorities talk about their markets. Huge difference. Number 17. you have people who get paid on an individual performance basis. Clients are smart enough to know that people who are paid for performance strive to maximize their individual performance, thus the individual payment. It's like going to the dentist who is the owner of a mercury mine. For him, the solution to any kind of tooth problem is yet another amalgam filling. Hey, dentistry may pay well, but selling tons of mercury may pay even better. And here comes the McKinsey and the old McKinsey bromide. If you can't measure it, you can't manage it. The problem is that business development is knowledge work, not manual labor. You can't treat business development the way you treat like digging ditches. With digging ditches, you know that if it takes 1 hour to dig one ditch, then one day a ditch digger can safely dig six ditches. Calculating for lunchtime and physical exhaustion over the 8 hour period. So that can be measured, but business development is not like that. It requires lots of thinking, judgment, and discernment, and you can't measure discernment, not even McKinsey can. Performance-based pay may be great for people working on assembly lines or digging ditches, but not for people who have to do extensive thinking in their work. Now, there is overwhelming evidence that talents, the caliber of people you should recruit anyway, don't work for money. They work for basically fulfillment, but most employers don't know it yet, or even if they know it, they don't want to acknowledge it, and they mistakenly believe that highly talented people, money is the number one factor. It's actually number five or seven, I'm if I remember correctly, somewhere in that region between five and seven. That's why you can't motivate talented people with money. Yes, they earn enormous amounts of money, but they don't work for the money. They have higher callings. So where is the proof that performance payment fails in the knowledge worker environment? Just read Dan Pink's book, Drive and See. He piles up mountains of evidence against performance payments in the knowledge environment. There's an MIT study called the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston Working Paper number 0511, July 2005. And here's a quotation in that. As long as the task involved only mechanical skills, aka manual labor, bonuses worked as they would be expected. The higher the pay, the better the performance. In 8 of the 9 tasks we examined, complex tasks requiring serious brain work, across the 3 experiments, higher incentives led to worse performance. And the study from the London School of Economics, from Dr. Brand Ehrlenbusch, we find that financial incentives in knowledge work can result in negative impact on overall performance. So these are just 2 pieces of evidence, but there's more. Individual performance payment sends teamwork to hell in a handbasket, and now you are in trouble. Your people will perform all over the map in order to increase their individual performance. Using an example from the world of athletics, you can have the world's fastest runners in your 4x400 meter relay team, but if they run in any direction they feel like, then there's a problem. But this is how sales forces operate in most IT companies. Upon hiring, every single salesperson receives their instruction from the sales manager: get out and sell more and sell some more. There is no structure, just go and sell as much as you can. It's like telling a newly recruited soldier, just get out and kill. Kill more and kill anyone who can increase your personal quota of corpses. In my experience, most companies use the pay-for-performance scam because they don't want to waste energy and money on proper recruitment. But look at elite military units like the Navy SEAL or Delta Force. Recruitment and training are expensive, but then talent attrition is virtually zero, except being killed in action or dropping out for medical reasons. Those folks don't quit because someone has offered them better jobs for more money. And as we know, soldiers are notoriously poorly paid. So, since companies want to increase their sales, they measure sales. So they pay their salespeople commissions. But how far can you trust people whose sole objective is to manipulate as much money out of your pocket as possible? I wouldn't trust them as far as I could kick them, personally. And this is one of the very reasons why buyers avoid commissioned peddlers like the plague. These sellers are pushy because they are pushing for their own money. And their sales managers and their company's executives are too stupid and narrow-minded to recognize how much damage these bizarre hucksters cause with their money-chasing behavior. So, commission or no commission? In my experience, no commission. Commission-based sales force costs far too much time, energy, and money to manage. Point 18, the market first meets the company through its sales pitches. Replaceable vendor companies chase the market with sales pitches, so this is the only way the market can meet them. What sort of materials do vendors hand out to their prospects? Self-centered materials with lots of superlatives, platitude, and general chest beating. I'm Dr. Diamond Dick, with a triple PhD in computer science and a quadruple MBA in finance. And now, let me tell you more about myself. Brochures, quotations, and similar wastage of rainforests, basically. And how do buyers respond to this lunacy? Buyers use these sellers as basis of comparison to other companies. Nothing unique, nothing distinct. The only difference is who can offer the same, very similar services at the lowest price. By contrast, respected authority caliber companies make sure prospects meet them through education-based marketing materials. For instance, CRM vendors have flashy, glitzy brochures full of look how cute we are and smart we are type information. But respected CRM authority companies have educational pieces like 10 considerations medium-sized manufacturing companies must address when selecting CRM systems, or 10 costly mistakes medium-sized manufacturing companies make when selecting CRM systems. Why brochures are received with a "you too man, yawn yawn," educational pieces are valuable and highly sought after by top decision makers. There must be a reason why white papers and not brochures are decision makers' favorite educational materials when searching for solutions. So, where is the problem then? Brochures are cheaper to produce than white papers. And technically illiterate salespeople are cheaper to employ than salespeople with significant technical and business acumen. The best of those folks demand hefty base payments. So keep an eye on which of your company's materials your market meets when first meeting your company's name. This will have a huge impact on your brand and the overall perception of your company. After all, I can confidently say you'll sooner meet a virgin prostitute than a haggler in a BMW dealership. That's just how BMW operates. Number 19. top-notch technology comes before top-notch people. For vendor-type IT companies, budgetary preference is given to technology, and whatever is left is used for hiring more people. Just more headcount. Not better, just more. For some reason, many IT companies are obsessed with headcount. They think the more people they have, the better. Their mentality is to acquire top technology and some top-notch technical folks. Then dirt cheap, rock-bottom quality workforce to operate that technology to work the rest of the company. A few months ago, a local IT company was considering hiring me to keep the $90 to $150 an hour programmers fully occupied, and the lawyer turned owner was grilling me about how many hours I was planning to work. I repeatedly asked him about the objectives he wanted to achieve, but he kept getting back to the number of my working hours. His justification was that since he would pay me a generous $12 an hour, he would need to know how much I would cost him. When I told him I wouldn't even entertain the idea of having his company as a client for less than an annual $100,000 plus a percentage of sales, his response was, "Are you out of your mind? That's almost as much as my best software developers make." And I suggested to him that he would ask his programmers to market and sell what they create if they wanted to eat and pay the bills and put the phone down. In his view, the technical people were the real assets, and all the other people operating the company and selling his cutting-edge stuff. Oh, please, cutting-edge again. So all these people were just necessary evil, just pain in the ass, but necessary to keep to sell what these technical geniuses produce. As a technical layman, he was quite obsessed with technology while looking down on everything else, especially on the mundane and menial grunt work of taking his stuff to the market and exchange it for money. And his company keeps struggling, partly because he's obsessed with hiring more technical people, more developers. Respected expert companies focus on hiring top-tier talents and, if needed, slightly compromise on technology folks. This may sound silly, but your company makes money by marketing and selling technology, not merely making technology. And no matter how good your technology people are, you still need people to take your technology to the market and sell it to keep your technical geniuses alive. Top talents using slightly less than top technology far outperform competitively paid, merely competitive people struggling to make sense of cutting-edge technology. While living in the UK, once I was dating a finishing carpenter. For most of her work, she used hand tools, not power tools. Of course, the engineer in me was curious, and I asked her about it. How come? Although she told me, the best explanation sank in only when her dad, an accomplished orthopedic surgeon, explained it. It was eye-opening. "Tom, we get paid exorbitant amounts of money because we have a high degree of skills and hand-eye coordination in our profession that machines can never achieve. There are so many variables at any one time that skilled experts can foresee and handle, but machines can't. How comfortable would you be lying down on the operating table if a robot were wielding the scalpel?" He made a point. One of the most critical parts of surgery is performed by a $30 tool, the humble scalpel. That was according to John Kirkup's Evolution of Surgical Instruments, invented over 1 million years ago. Then band continued, and no matter how expertly you use all the fancy instruments, if you don't have excellent scalpel skills, you will never become an excellent surgeon. You can be a well-educated and excellent equipment user, but not an excellent surgeon. And Rock told me, well, Roxanne for short, Rock told me the same about carpentry. You can have the best power tools, but without having the principles of carpentry both in your brain and in your fingers, you are just a power tool operator, not a carpenter. It's the people who make the most significant difference in your business, not the technology. Number 20, selling tasks, time chunks, and materials. Fungible vendors sell collections of means to ends and charge for these means. It's like the builder who regards his buildings as collections of bricks, sand, bags of cement, timber, and nails, but totally ignores the beauty and comfort of an exquisite home. IT vendors sell time chunks, pages of documentations, lines of codes, and the poundage of the steel and plastic that make up computer systems. They set their fees and prices based on the amount of labor they have to perform to put these pieces of plastic and steel in place. Respected experts sell brighter futures to their clients, results, outcomes, and possibilities. And they base their fees and prices on the business improvement what their clients want to achieve. There is a world of difference between selling 100 computer terminals, 50 routers, 50 switches, and 200 hours of labor, and selling an opportunity to reduce client attrition by 35% within 9 months. Number 21, most vendors imitate each other so they are easily comparable. With imitation, the only basis of comparison for buyers is the lowest price. Who can offer a certain product or service the cheapest? Just look at most web hosting companies. Most of them are dirt cheap, no doubt, and total disaster. And the way they treat their clients is plain atrocious, but for the money they charge, it's great that they even offer something, even at that bottom-achingly low quality. So it's not surprising the market demands rock-bottom prices. The market has equally low expectation of web hosting companies. A Verisage Institute founder Ron Baker is right in saying that you can make a service so cheap that nobody wants to buy it. A McDonald's Big Mac is around $1.99, and that includes the half a pound of meat, roughly quarter pound, half a pound, not much difference, bun, cheese, and other bits and bobs, including labor, and the company makes a profit on the Big Macs. So how low do you think the quality of the ingredients has to be to sell that burger for $1.99? Well, semi-erudite people wouldn't even feed their dogs with that crap, I believe. Mind you, lots of people even dare to eat it. There must be some brave souls on this planet, tempting fate every day, or maybe I'm just a coward. And some people tell me skydiving is dangerous. Well, I think relative to eating McDonald's food-like substances, skydiving is pretty safe. The fact is that it's sellers who commoditize themselves with imitation, and the market merely fulfills their wishes. There is no such thing as a commodity until we give in and start treating our business as commodities. Point 22, the absence of strategic focus and direction. Vendor-type companies tend to jump from opportunity to opportunity, depending on how much short-term money they can make on certain opportunities. They invent solutions by the seat of their pants based on what prospects are looking for, Web design, yo, we can do that. Staff training, yo, we can handle that. ERP system design, yo, we can do that. Internet security, yo, we're the experts. And smart buyers smell the rat right from a million miles and run. By dabbling into various aspects of IT, companies trivialize the very areas they are getting into. And then using this trivialized mindset, they start the selling process. And what happens? Buyers sniff out that sellers treat their own services as trivial, so buyers start haggling, because now it's a trivial service. And by then, it's far too late to change the situation. Buyers will keep haggling until they get sufficiently low prices. Respected authority type companies have their strategies carved in stone, and they follow their directions. They have rigid strategies, ends, and flexible tactics, means. Most vendors have rigid tactics and flexible strategies. We keep doing this and let's see where it takes us. They operate on the mantra of, we keep doing this and let's see where we end up. It's like a doctor who thinks to himself, I keep doing bloodletting on my patients and let's see how many survives. Mind you, considering the overall health of people, we can confidently say that Western-style medicine hasn't come too far from the point of bloodletting and leeches. So in summary, let's see. So here we are at the end of our journey. I reckon there are more than 22 differentiating factors between vendors and authorities, but for a start, these 22 are good enough. But the problem is that in many IT companies, the very activities that could help to establish them as respected authorities are banned because they cost more than dirt cheap. It's easy to ban things. It's a bit harder to figure out how to do it better. Many IT companies don't want to invest in marketing because it costs money, whereas hiring an army of peddlers on straight commission seems to be cheap. It reminds me of the sad story of haggis, the traditional Scottish delicacy. During the mad cow disease outbreak in 1989, the US Department of Agriculture banned the offal-based dish in the US, claiming it was unsafe for human consumption. The USDA was supposed to lift the ban in 2010, but it's still sitting on the decision. Although both the Scottish Rural Affairs Department and the British Food Standards Agency have declared haggis to be safe to eat. The way I see it, if haggis is unsafe to eat, then considering the quality of the crap it sells, McDonald's should be taken to court for crime against humanity. Yes, people can get American haggis, but it's like Chinese Rolex watches. They are shiny like the real ones, but something is missing. That's why it costs only $10, not $10,000. The American haggis is made of beef and is missing a key ingredient, sheep's lungs. And instead of sheep's stomach, it is stuffed into plastic bags. And considering that in Europe, most people wouldn't feed rats with the kind of food we eat in North America, it's strange that the USDA still keeps the ban in place while giving the go-ahead to dangerous and obnoxious food-like substances like pasteurized milk. And the same is happening in many IT companies regarding marketing. Too many people are too invested in keeping the old order in operation, even at the detriment of the company's bottom line. Why? Because it doesn't cost much, but it doesn't produce much either. But costs are easier to measure than judging and discerning projections on opportunities. The former needs only a calculator and any moron can do it. The latter needs pretty high level of business savvy and insights, the kind of savvy and insights that are expensive and not many IT companies are willing to acquire talents who possess them. By the way, the USDA declared sheep lungs to be unsuitable for human consumption thus illegal to distribute in 1971. I'm curious when the USDA bans the Big Mac and similar suspicious substances cleverly disguised as food, but that topic is for a different newsletter. So look at these 22 factors and just inspect your own company based on these 22 points. And that's a good start. And while you're doing that, I'm sure you will come up with your own inspection points, and then bring those inspection points to your equation and regularly inspect your company on these points, and then you will see that you will get farther and farther away from the vendor status and get closer and closer to the respected authority status. In the meantime, keep up the good work. Enjoy the week, and we'll talk in a few weeks' time.